This is Flight Training the Way I See It with Mike Schiffer.
Welcome to another episode of Flight Training the Way I See It, opinion and news by your host, Mike Schiffer from CFI Bootcamp. Welcome if it's your first time. If you've been a longtime listener on the podcast series, welcome back. We're going to talk today about the video podcast of our May 2022 newsletter. And what we're going to be talking about is multi-engine flying and teaching tips in a three-part series. We're finishing that series now. So if you missed episodes one and two of the three-part series, then you can go back to the podcast and listen to those. We're also going to talk about why CFI training can take a long time when you do it on your own. I'm going to talk and maybe help you with some ideas about how you can make it better for yourself. And then we're going to talk about why is the seep spiral entered upwind? And it's a combination of performance and ground reference maneuvers. So why is it entered upwind? All the other ground reference maneuvers are entered downwind for a good reason. We'll talk about that. Also, some product updates. We'll give you some updates on what's coming out the door here at CFI Bootcamp. And we're going to have our 100th Power Hour here in June. In August. We're going to do something very special for that. And there'll also be getting, you'll be getting something very special in your email in about 2 weeks, approximately, maybe a little less than that. So I won't tell you what it is, but if you've been waiting to purchase things for CFI Bootcamp, particularly anything expensive, you might just like that email. I'm just going to tell you that. So there you go. You'll have that here in a little bit. So let's talk about the multi-engine flying tips. These are from Hobie Tomlinson, who is probably the best guru on multi-engine flying there is, in our country at least. And he's a DPE from Burlington, Vermont, and he's offered to give up some tips. And we'll continue those with single engine, seaplane, all kinds of things as we go through. We'll have a three-part series dedicated to just those things. So let's look at the first tip. Never switch fuel tanks after run-up or in the vicinity of an airport before landing. This can lead to problems in fuel delivery systems. So this means that once you have solidly verified you've got fuel in the tank, you can only make it worse by switching to the other tank. If you can test that tank when you're in flight, come back to the airport if you need to, the other tank, or many things. But don't once you've tested and you've got good fuel before takeoff, then don't switch it. That's the first thing. A lot of people have done that, and in particular with airplanes like the Beech Baron 55 models, where you had one fuel gauge for each tank, but you had four total tanks. So not only switch the tanks, but switch the gauge over to show the fuel in the corresponding tanks. That kind of could lead to some bad outcomes. So let's not do that. Second thing is, in the event of an emergency en route, divert to an airport with approach aids and with a runway of at least 6,000 feet, unless a more significant emergency exists to make you land more immediately. So this allows you to have enough runway on a single engine, or whatever your problem is, to be able to consume the runway if you need to. A lot of times, runways that are this big, 6,000 feet, may have fire protective services around, or maybe a control tower at airport that can help you. So, and approach aids are very handy, especially at unfamiliar airports, because then you'll be able to get down safer, stay above the VASI, or stay slightly above the VASI. If it has one, or PAPI, even better. And if not, good ILS, the glide slope, can help you, just as a nav aid to get down. Number three is, always verify that the nose compartment is closed and locked. If it opens in flight, it can separate, and in some cases, it can fly into one of the propellers. So during my multi-engine training, it was in a Beech Traveler, and I was getting a multi-engine rating. And on the takeoff roll, I had the pilot examiner sitting in the back, and he was going to get a ride with us on the training flight down to where we're going to do the test, which is in Arizona. And so what happened was, we did takeoff roll, and I noticed the baggage compartment nose door coming up. And I called to abort the takeoff, and the instructor didn't want to do it. And I said, the baggage door is open, real quick. And so then I was able to throttle back, and then they were able to latch it. They had replaced something, serviced the battery or something, didn't get quite the latches in there right. Of course, that's a pre-flight faux pas. So anyway, that bode well for me, because the guy who was going to give me the test was sitting in the back, and sort of like, I made sure that flight was going to be just fine, right? There you go. So that's your three tips for this week. And we do have a few more, which I'll probably just sprinkle in to the next few podcasts, but of the multi-engine one, so we can round out Hobie's stuff. But we'll begin the next series on tips for single engine airplanes in terms of tips and technique for teaching, okay? The next thing we want to talk about is why flight CFI training can take a long time when you do it on your own. One of the biggest things we hear at CFI Bootcamp is how long things take to get anything done. So for example, typical flights and meetings with CFIs kind of go like this, where it's like, well, how many flights do you think it's going to take? The answer is, we'll see. I don't know yet. What do we have to do to get through the program, to get CFI? Well, there's a lot of self-study to do. You got to create your own lesson plans, and we'll meet once a week. That's surefire way to make sure that your CFI training takes years and years and years to accomplish, if it gets accomplished at all. So that's, you know, we hear a lot of that. So CFI students become very frustrated with this approach. And one of the reasons that CFI training can lead to a long time on your own is the CFI maybe you pick to do your training has either never done one or only does them occasionally, every once in a while. And so the information is not very fresh. And this information is very perishable, especially those things related to the fundamentals of instructing from the Aviation Instructor's Handbook. So there are a lot of CFIs who have 2 years experience and over 200 hours dual given, which is the minimum requirement in a Part 61 environment to train CFI students on the flight. But of those CFIs, most of them are soloing students, doing private pilot recommendations for practical tests, training for that. Maybe they're doing the odd instrument one every once in a while. And if they're doing double I, they may do some instrument training. But in general, they're centric to private pilots, student pilots, 90% of the time. And so things that are in that land, they know. But things that are outside of it, they don't. If you want a really good acid test, try this. Ask your CFI who's going to do your training how you solo somebody who doesn't hold the appropriate category and class rating. So, for example, a rotorcraft student who comes to you, helicopter, who wants to solo an airplane, right? Now if your school is connected to a school that has rotorcraft operations, they're going to know the answer to that, right? But in general, these are some of the specialty areas in CFI training that your flight instructor is going to have to know the regulations very well and know how to maneuver through them very well. So the answer to that, by the way, is this rotorcraft pilot, if he holds a private pilot certificate, recreational or commercial pilot certificate sport, is not a student pilot. So, and can never be again unless they lose all their certificates, right? So once a student pilot is graduated and got certificated with some other certificate, they're not a student pilot anymore. So when this rotorcraft pilot comes to you, say private pilot, you do not use the student pilot rules at all to solo the student. There's a special rule, which is 6131 Delta 2. And this basically says if you want to act as PIC of an aircraft that you don't hold the category and class in, you don't have the ratings, then a CFI can give you a solo endorsement as long as they have completed the training for the certificate level you're trying to achieve, and assuming that you're safe. And then that endorsement is good forever. There's no 90 days. There's no additional follow-up endorsements. So if that private pilot rotorcraft wants to fly from here in Opa-locka to Billings, Montana, the next day, they can. They want to fly at night, they can. So there's no restrictions on it. It just can't take a passenger. So a lot of CFIs won't know that answer. And so I don't know how, therefore, they will be able to train you correctly. What else don't they know? That's what I would say. So we've got that. The other areas that come up are the fundamentals of instructing. Typically, if you don't really be able to quiz your CFI is going to give you the instruction, but in general, if you get the answer of like, well, when are we going to do the fundamentals of instructing? I said, well, I think you should write a lesson plan for those. That means they don't know, right? That means that they want you to write a lesson plan, so to teach it to yourself, and then they'll listen to it. You also will know when they open up the Aviation Instructor's Handbook and are reading it while you're talking to them in a particular chapter, because they're looking to see if it's in there, and maybe it was, and maybe I saw that before, I'm not sure. Or they read from the book, which is worse. So when you run into those cases, you're going to have to do some self-education. So you need an online course of some kind, like ours, CFIbootcamp.com. It's our online course. Covers all of that in lecture form, right? And there's a workbook in there as well to see that with scenarios, that kind of thing, to see that you're getting all this stuff. What we found is, with that online course, by the way, we found that people use CFI exactly as I described and still get pretty good successes, because the information that's in CFI Essentials, which comes with our online course, has a lot of extra resources. Like, we've got to give you a good example for that very case we talked about, from rotorcraft into airplane. So when you pose a scenario to yourself, you don't know whether you're getting the question right. You don't know whether you're solving the thing correctly. You may say, I think this is it. I would use this endorsement. Your CFI looks at it. Yeah, it looks good to me. But we have a product within CFI Essentials, which you get with the online course, or you can buy it separately. It's called Endorsements and Scenarios. We call it the Red Book inside of our company. And it's about 30 different scenarios divided up by student pilot scenarios, changing categories, classes, which is this case, changing category. There's recommending people for private pilot from different classes, like seaplane to airplane. There's a section on flight reviews and one-off activities, complex endorsements. So what you get is, it poses a scenario. It says exactly like we talked about, rotorcraft, helicopter to airplane, single engine land. And then you want to solo them. And so then what you see after the scenario is, you see a description of the answer in text, words, right along with the corresponding FARs. And then in most of the cases, not every single one, but most, there's a flow chart on the next page, which walks you through the regulations and how you get to that answer. So therefore, not only do you know if you got the right answer or not, but you see the logic through the FAR, or illogic, and find out how that answer was derived. So those are the kind of things that we generated a long time ago, to, because we know where the rough spots are on the road, right? And this is one of them. So that's one thing. So, you know, and then writing your own lesson plans is rough, because the reason people do this or want you to do this is because most pilots' aeronautical knowledge isn't very good. You know, it may have been good at one time, maybe, but it's probably not as good as it should be today. And yet now you're charted with not only knowing it, but teaching it. The big areas that tend to have trouble are aerodynamics, right? That's one. It comes up all the time. We have difficulties with teaching aerodynamics because we don't understand it ourselves. And then other things like the fundamentals instructing. That's going to be a challenge, right? Aaron, you know, you're not responsible for that until the CFI, so that wouldn't have been something. Airspace, especially E and G, big challenges. So again, you're left with creating these lesson plans to do two things. So that you have one, and the second is to really to shore up your aeronautical knowledge, because you'll have to create one and then you'll see all the things you don't know. And somehow you read all the airplane flying handbook, pilot's handbook of aeronautical knowledge, the FAR AIM, whatever, to get yourself back up to speed. So we do not do that, because like a carpenter doesn't make his own saw, right? And if I teach a class in a university or wherever, or you get a substitute teacher comes in teaching your high school class, they don't make their own lesson plan for that class, do they? No, they use the lesson plan that's there. We've been teaching flying for well over 100 years. I think these lesson plans exist, right? These plans exist. Now, you may have to modify them to meet your specific needs, but these exist. So you just teach from ours. We teach you how to make one. You do a couple in class, for sure, so you understand the structure and how to. But our lesson plans all follow. They've been tested over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students. So they go in the right order. They say the right things. They get the right result, right? So just use those. Why not use the best lesson plan you can, right? I mean, who would not want to do that? And then so what we do about the aeronautical knowledge. So that's where our online course kicks in. So what we do is, we have two sides to that. There's one for aeronautical knowledge, and there's one called 30-hour practical course. It's 42 hours, this course is. 30 hours of it is as if you were in a lectured CFI class with graphics and things behind me. And then the other side is aeronautical knowledge. And that's things like airspace, FARs, aerodynamics, that kind of thing. So we bring up the level there along with assessments, right? So when you're done with that, you're kind of ready to roll. And then we do our 7-day immersive class, which I just finished last week. In fact, yesterday I finished, which was on the 22nd of April, or not April, May. So, and in that class, we use the information in the online course. So we say, today, right now, we're going to solo a student. So let's go through what we need to do. Let's generate a pre-solo knowledge test, or modify one that we have access to, provide the correct endorsements, what are the training requirements, and then we start stepping through endorsements like this rotorcraft pilot. Now we say, what are the training requirements? Those are located in the FAR. What are the endorsements? Those are in the AC, 6165 Hotel. And then, what are the testing requirements? So this is not going to be a complete full private pilot test because they already hold private pilot. So just as an additional category rating, so there's a ratings task table in the appendix, which says what tasks must be tested, not everything. So for example, on the ground, it's only performance limitations and operation of aircraft systems. The rest of it is not necessary to be tested. So these are the kind of things, because what you really want out of the CFI thing is you want to be operational. So yes, you want to pass the test, right, good on you. But you want to be able to go to any flight school, look at their syllabus, take your stuff that you have from us, and begin using it right away. Start teaching that particular lesson. That's really what you want. Now, you may not be 1,000% successful, but I can guarantee you that people who leave our place think they can do that, and mostly can do that fine, right? Because of the training. So because we have a week of immersive training, not teaching you aerodynamics, not reteaching you things that the online course did for us. So we've got that. So we've got that going for us. So that week of immersive training is followed by another week, the second week, of just flights and ground to proficiency. And then we concentrate at that point, we concentrate on the specific DPE that's going to do your test. That's kind of the way we do that. So if you made your own lesson plans, you're going to have to create around 150. You've got about 80 for the private and commercial maneuvers, CFI. There's a few CFI maneuvers. There are extra things. The rest of them are from the technical subject areas, from the ACS for private, for commercial, and for some for flight instructor. So that's what you've got ahead of you. And I think that really just leads to a lot of work. And the work has already been done, which is really what's the most frustrating part, right? And I understand how people would want you to make your own and the reasons, but and I understand that you wouldn't want to pay a CFI to sit with you and teach you this all over again because it could be quite pricey. So that's why we solved that with our online course. But that's us. So let's see if there's anything else I wanted to take. So when you're done, like with our stuff, it takes about 60 hours. This can help you in terms of time. 60 hours of to go through the online course and to complete the workbook and do the assessments, 60, 70. Then you come to a 7-day class, or you do an equivalent somewhere. That's 42 hours more. So currently you have somewhere around 100 hours of instruction, ground instruction, that you've received, whether it's online or in person. Then we would do another approximately 10 hours of pre- and post-flight briefings, you teaching the maneuver to one of us before we go fly. And on top of that, probably another 5 to 8 hours of just one-to-one instruction for the specific DPE. So you look at this, you've got 120 hours of instruction that's been somehow imparted into you. That's going to get a result, right? Either we do it, or you do it, or you and your CFI do it, but someone's got to do it. That doesn't count your own study right away. It does, well, the first part, 60 hours does. But there's additional study, and typically people in our CFI program will study approximately 3 hours per night. So that's basically another, first week is seven days. So you've got that, and then you have the other week, which is variable. So it's somewhere around another 30 hours. So, you know, you look at this whole thing, you've got nearly, just edging towards 150, 200 hours of actual ground instruction and self-study that's gone into this, maybe more. So so that's a lot, and that will achieve a result. The issue is, if you try to do it on your own, you kind of don't know where to start, and you don't know where to end, and you don't know what's good enough, and you, like, how much of this do I really have to know, and how much, that's where a specialty company like us or someone else who knows this is indispensable to you, because they know how to guide the ship, right, now to get you through all this. So if you're going to do the self-study route, make a study outline for every day. So what I mean by this, it's what I do when I attack a problem about studying for some exam or whatever I have to do. So what I mean by it is on a piece of paper, several pieces of paper, right? One for each study session, you're going to identify how much time you think you need to put into this to call it done. So maybe it's the CFI program, the entire program. You say, I've done the online course, I did the 7-day class, and now I need the areas I was weak on is this, 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 this. And so you say, okay, that's about, if I add up all the times that I think it's going to take for each of those things, I need another 25, 30 hours of studying, something like that. And then you say, how many days do I have? How many evenings, how many nights, how many days do I have to dedicate before the check ride? Because you have to have a stop date in order for this to work. And then you say, okay, the first day, I'm going to do 3 hours, and it's going to be on these topics. These are the resources I need. Airplane flying handbook, aviation instructor's handbook, whatever it is, FAR-AIM. And this is what my outcome needs to be. You set an outcome. And the outcome can't always be, I know it. It's got to be something more tangible. Like you can explain it. You could maybe rattle off the mnemonics for that chapter without too much hesitation. You could take an assessment from the workbook and pass it. There's something like that. Okay, and you do that for every single period before you start, before you even start studying. So now you've got, say, 10 of these, maybe 15, depending on how many hours you're going to spend. And then what it does is it keeps you on track because you say, this is what I'm going to do each day. And then you can also modify it and say, you know, I didn't need as much time. So I can take the rest of them, the others, and I can modify the times a little bit because they're similar. Or you can add times. So there's that. So that's a study guide, a study outline, which is what I use. All right, the second task I wanted to tell you was why steep spirals are entered upwind. It's a combination performance and ground ground reference maneuver, so why upwind? All the other ground reference maneuvers are done downwind. So the reason for that is, well, let's talk about why you enter downwind on all the ground reference maneuvers. It's because the ACS, PTS, and the Airplane Flying Handbook all point to the idea that you shouldn't use any more than 45 degrees bank at the maximum point where you'd need it the most, which is downwind, right? Directly, that's when your ground speed is the highest. So your turn radius would be the largest, so you have to control it with bank angle. So if you were doing turns around a point and you entered upwind by mistake, and maybe you wanted to keep, I don't know, a half mile distance, and all of a sudden it took you like 35 degrees of bank right then, because the wind is super strong to maintain that. Well, by the time you get around downwind, if you chose that, you may need 70 degrees of bank, 60 degrees of bank, in order to keep the same radius. So that's not going to work, right? But if you start off downwind, you put in the full 45 and you drifted further, so you say, oh my, I can't possibly hold a half mile today because the wind is so strong, it's going to be 3/4. Then all the other bank angles going all the way through the upwind and back are not going to be more than 45 because that's your steepest, right? So that's the reason you would enter a maneuver downwind like that. But the steep spiral, it's interesting. It is a ground reference maneuver. You're orbiting. If you don't know what a steep spiral is, it's a maneuver that's upwards of 60 degrees of bank you can use. And you're to do three turns, three complete turns, holding the same airspeed, which is a glide speed. And then you're to roll out on the third turn at within 10 degrees and within 10 knots. And you're going to lose a lot of altitude, right? So in the aero, we would lose somewhere around 4,000 feet, 5,000 feet. So we'd have to start at like 7,000 feet. So then you go, okay, it's a ground reference maneuver too, because you're orbiting over a spot on the ground, right? So you're orbiting over a spot on the ground. So this might be useful for an emergency landing. It might be useful if you were on fire, or co-emergency descent probably be a little better, but you'd have a place to land at the end. The idea is you're not going too far from where you need to be. So that's the point of this thing. So yes, it's a performance maneuver because you've got to maintain a particular airspeed. You're doing a certain number of times, but it's also a bit of a ground reference maneuver too because you're orbiting over a spot and you vary the bank angle to stay over the spot and you can use up to 60 degrees of bank. So you would think, okay, why do I enter this upwind? By the way, the text doesn't say it. If you look in the Airplane Flying Handbook, current version, it doesn't say it. Although the diagram indicates upwind. And if you look at the previous handbook, it doesn't say it. Version of the handbook, I should say. Doesn't say. It just shows you an image, right? And you get the idea, this thing's entered upwind. Is this a mistake? Nope, it's not a mistake. So then you go back to the handbooks, which are what I do. So I'm curious. So I want to find out the reason the maneuver is done in a particular way or why they changed it. So I start going back to the handbooks. And there was no mention of this until, at least the handbooks I could find, there probably was, but the handbook that solved it was the 1965 Flight Training Handbook. It was called Flight Training Handbook. It's available, you'll find it online. You can either buy it or you can get it as a download somewhere. And it was made by the FAA. And there was a picture in there, a line art. It wasn't a picture, it was line art. And this maneuver, they said, was to be done not less than 10 turns. Ooh, 10 turns, yes. They said because pilots typically won't become disoriented or get vertigo until after about 3 or 4 turns. Then they start getting vertigo because they lose space of their position, spatial disorientation, all that. So it was number one to develop that awareness in you of how to stay spatially aware and not get vertigo. And it also was designed to keep you over the approach end of a runway, or very close to the approach end, perhaps a quarter mile away, something like close, right? Something quarter, half to quarter, well, I think it was a quarter mile if you looked at the figure. But anyway, the idea was if you started upwind and you did how many turns you needed to do to get down, then by that, when you rolled out on that last turn, you'd be straight into the wind and landing on the runway that was right in front of you, the one you picked that was into the wind. That was the reason. And if you were too high, then you would do a modified traffic pattern to come back, but still land into the wind. So this is the reason it started upwind, so that when you're done with it and you roll that on the 360-degree heading that you started on, you'll be straight down the gut of the runway and into the wind. So it can be a little problematic, this maneuver. And if you're at altitude and you pick a point, as a bit of advice to you, you're going to have to pick a point that's very, very close to the airplane, appears close to the airplane. So a half mile at 1,000 feet, if you had a Cessna, you could look out of your window with the wings level, and you could look at the strut. And if that point touches the strut, the point you're looking at, or the road, or the airport, or a pylon, or whatever it is, if it's halfway up the strut, if you look out there and it's cutting the strut about a halfway, that's a half mile with the wings level. If a quarter, it's a quarter mile. This only works about 1,000 feet. So that same half mile spacing, you really on the steep spiral want about a quarter mile spacing. So you're looking where that is, and that's a quarter up the strut. If you use that as your basis when you're up at about 4,000, 5,000 feet, it's too far. That same distance at 5,000 feet is more, is a mile or more. So you're not gonna be able to make a steep spiral. You're gonna make a shallowest spiral. So what we tell our students to do is to put the point underneath where the tire, between where the tire is and the fuselage. So almost nearer to the fuselage. It's very close, it looks close, but when you start doing the spirals, when you come down, you'll find that's about the right spacing. It'll be a quarter mile by the time you're done with it all, when you run all the turns. And again, this is to be done for commercial or CFI 3 turns. The hardest thing to control is the airspeed. The airspeed will vary with your angle of bank because drag is changing on the airplane. So you will need to either lower or raise the nose because you have no power to maintain a glide speed. The glide speed, 172, 74 knots, that's what we're gonna use. We're gonna use the best glide speed. The actual manual from 1965 didn't say that. It said to use between 1.3, about 1.3 VSO, pretty slow. And the reason, close to an approach speed. They said because the other thing we want to develop in the pilot is the awareness of if they change the pitch attitude during this maneuver, they're going to increase load factor. And you're gonna be slow enough already, so there's a chance to teach how to avoid accelerated stalls and to teach how you can stall an airplane while you're descending in a turn, right? So there's lots of goodies that come out of that. So that's the reason for it. And I would encourage you to go get that book. If I were teaching flying and I could take that book, change maybe some of the word choices because they're a bit dated, some of the word choices, change the images. But if I just used that book to teach people to fly, you would find the airplane flying handbook wouldn't be this big. It would be that big. And we'd achieve the same result. So that's interesting. I like that book. It's not a book I'm going to tote around and teach from, but I mean, I gain insight from that book. So I read it quite often. And you should too. Now, in the I did notice here that in the newsletter, if you join or belong to our newsletter, the subscription, there's a link in this newsletter that you would get, which has a link to that book. So it's I already did it for you. I just forgot that I did it for you. So if you don't belong to our newsletter subscription area, then go to our website, cfibootcamp.com, and you'll find a place to opt into it. The other thing you want to opt into is our power hour. So every Saturday, we're approaching nearly 100 power hours. We do a deep dive into some kind of topic, some aviation topic. We've done everything from the mathematics behind 8-zone pylons to we've done things we did, how to become an airline pilot fastest way. We did that last week. We've had people like Gary Reeves, guy in a pink shirt, who's the guru of IFR, talking to us about autopilot pro tips, about flying IFR. We've had VFR stuff flying in Europe. We've had cross-country flying around the country with a pencil stopwatch. and a chart, that simple, right? Using the 1-in-60 rule and track angle closing error methods to navigate. So those kind of things, all kinds of topics. FOI, we've talked about that. How to study for your CFI test, talked about that. So that, you join the Power Hour by going to our website, cfibootcamp.com, and on the, any of those pages, but particularly the first page, there's a red bar at the bottom, and it's click to join the Power Hour. Then you get an email, and the email reminder will be, it'll tell you sometime Wednesday or Thursday, it will tell you what the topic's going to be. And then it will send you a reminder 1 hour before the show starts. It's a show. There's between 50 and 200 people that will be on in there in that room. It's a Zoom meeting, and it's a full-on show. And then there will be another email which will come out to you so the hour before, then a few minutes before its show is starting. So you get like two or three reminder emails. So if you're out about and we have people who have been listening to our podcast, I mean the Power Hours, for the whole 100 times. You know, they've been every Saturday I see them. So it's kind of a little cult following. Then the other thing we've done recently is at the end of the show, we open up the room, back up again, and we unmute people. So if you have questions, we can help you with something, or if you want to comment on something, or we'll just tell you what we're doing at CFI Bootcamp that week to give you an idea of you know, the progress we're making on this or that. So that's a really good thing to do. There's other things you can opt in there too. There's also our membership site, which is free. There is a paid one, but there's a free one, and it, believe me, it's got plenty in it to keep you engaged. It's, if you opt into the CFI, the Power Hour program, instead of paying, if you're gonna join the membership site, not join the free site, which is fine, but if you want the deluxe thing, we usually charge $22 a month for that. But if you're a boot, if you're a Power Hour subscriber, then you get it for $9. And a lot of people do that. Okay, let me give you a few product updates here as we begin to close out. So a lot's been happening to our training materials. We're in the process and very close to completing revisions to almost all of our custom books. So if you purchase any of our products within a year of today, you'll get the latest version for free. You will have received, or when it's out, you'll receive an email from us telling us, giving you the links to the latest works, the latest books, latest versions. If you have CFI Essentials, that product's already been updated for you if you have the Dropbox. You'll have to go click on your link, and if you're using it like a real Dropbox, it'll be updated automatically. If you just happen to download all the content and didn't leave it connected or synced to Dropbox, then you'll need to re-download it. But there's that. We can help you with that, but I think most of you know. Or we'll send you a new link, that could be. So there's that. So that, but Dropbox automatically updates when we make changes to it. And there's a list of the products, in case you have any, that have been recently updated, or if you want. So we made an enormous number of changes to Teach Brief Fly, the Instructor Edition. There were 1,248 changes. So some of them were rewrites, some of them were typos, some of them were punctuation, some of them were just, I found a better way to say something. Formatting could be something that was formatted a little differently, a font that was different in one letter, or some, one thing, I don't know, a lot of stuff. Then we also updated the Teach Brief Fly Student Companion Guide to align with the new Airplane Flying Handbook. So the references there now align up with the new Airplane Flying Handbook. We updated Endorsements and Scenarios, the red book I was telling you about, which has all the endorsements and scenarios around the student pilots and so on. And there were some errors there in the, one of the scenarios, or two of them, and a flowchart that was in the wrong place, so we fixed all that. We updated, made substantial changes to the CheckRide Quick Study Guide, CheckRide Quick Self-Study Guide, which we use in our class a lot. So we changed some of the flashcards. We put them, because there's new chapters, they didn't line up to the new Aviation Instructor's Handbook, now they do. And then we also rewrote and changed some of the titles for the FARs that you know explained. So there was a bit of work there. The flight instructor workbook went through an enormous change. It was a lot of work. And also it has a quizzing engine in it so that when you get the assessments, if you click on the answers, it will actually grade it whether you're online or not. It runs Java to do that. And it can grade out your assessments as you go. We made substantial revisions and changes to the flight instructor lesson plans. There were a lot of changes there. So those came right out of Teach Brief Fly. If you just have lesson plans, you have only lesson plans of Teach Brief Fly. Teach Brief Fly, by the way, has lesson plans in it. In the middle part of the book, it has pre-flight briefings, things you would show on the board, artwork you would generate just before giving a flight. And the third part of the book is what to say in the airplane, the exact words or things to say while you're demonstrating a maneuver. So Teach Brief Fly. And then the CFI self-study guide for the online course was updated to align with the new aviation instructor's handbook, the airplane flying handbook, and so on. And we're currently working on updating other books this quarter. You can expect an update by the end of June for that. For those of you who are sort of following along, so the next trade show I'll be at is EAA Air Venture. So I'll be in Oshkosh in the end of July for that. And I won't be speaking this year. So I'll be there. I'll be in the SAFE, S-A-F-E, Society of Aviation and Flight Educators booth for most of the time, if I'm not walking around or having to do something. And I'll be there for about 2 days. I haven't decided which day. So if you want to meet up, that'd be the place to do it. The other places will be at FASANA, which is Flight Association of North America. That's going to be, I believe it's in March, or I have to look at the time frame again, but it's soon, next year. All these, outside Air Venture, everything is next year. So Air Venture is this year. It's the last thing that's here. So let me grab the dates here for you, in case you're, so you don't have to look at it on your own. FASANA is March 1st through 3rd. It's in Orlando, and so it's a drive for me. So I'll be there for that, and I'll probably speak at that. I'll probably have a speaking part there. We have Air Venture, which is July 25th through the 31st of this year, of 2022. Sun and Fun. So I'll be speaking at Sun and Fun in a forum, probably more than one, from March the 28th to April 2nd. And then also I plan to speak at Air Venture next year. And also there's one last one. It's Redbird Migration. So that's one of my favorites. It's a flight training conference. It's April the 11th and 12th, and it's going to be, that's of next year, it's going to be at EAA, probably at the museum at Oshkosh, right? It's going to be in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, April 11th and 12th, and I plan on speaking there too in some breakout sessions. So that's the idea. We'll see. None of this is confirmed yet, but that's what I'm working on. So that's all I've got until next month, and hopefully you've updated everything I have to do. There's some background chatter that from FAA now, there's a charting meeting, aeronautical chart users meeting that's coming up soon. So I just got an email on that. So I'm going to take a look and see what that's all about and see if that's anything we need to know anything about collectively. So also, keep your ear to the ground, because typically in June of each year, that's when they've released ACSs, new ACSs. It is quite possible that the flight instructor, which will be called aviation instructors, ACS, will be released next month. So I don't know that to be true. I don't know it to be a fact. I have to listen to my birds that whisper in my ear at FAA land and see what that's all about. But if it's going to happen, it usually would be in June. Historically, it's been in June. So let's keep up. Look at that. You can look at FAA.gov, and you can look in the training and testing side, and you'll find where the ACSs are. And have a look and see what's in there, because we might just get surprised here in just a little bit. Okay, that's it from here, from Miami Beach and CFI Bootcamp. I was your host, Mike Shiflett. I hope I educated you today and got you up to speed on a few things, maybe learned a few things you didn't know. And I didn't have much opinion this week, so I think I'm going to have a lot of opinion to make up for lack of opinion this time. So we'll see you next month on Flight Training the Way I See It. This has been a production of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, tips, and opinions.